So one of these days, black hole production could become a very spectacular result of quantum gravity phenomenology. And the interesting possibility, oops, go the right way here, is that that could conceivably even begin with the LHC. And so that's one of the things I'd like to talk about today, or I was asked to talk about today. The other, well, got to get things going the right way here. But another thing that I want to say is that even if we don't start encountering the spectacular physics at LHC, it's very much worth thinking about because consideration of black hole production at high energies is something that really leads us into some very profound theoretical issues. And so I'll talk a little bit about that today. I'll basically give a brief summary on both of these topics, first overviewing the essentials of the production at LHC story. And then I'll turn to this whole story of, well, what some of the more fundamental issues are with black hole production. And a recent review that covers some of the material of this talk is actually this one here, which came out in the past few months. So on the subject of LHC phenomenology, what I'm going to do is overview basically the overall story and outline some of the things that we do and don't know. And so those will become apparent as we go along. Okay, so the basic idea is that once we reach collision energies exceeding the Planck scale, then we should be able to form black holes. So whenever this happens, we are in for some quite spectacular physics. And in TeV scale gravity scenarios, the interesting thing is that the Planck scale could be as low as, well, roughly 1 TeV. The current bounds, lower bounds, are right around 1 TeV at present. And so this realization that we might produce black holes at the TeV scale, well, followed straightforwardly once we knew that we could have a realization of TeV scale gravity and was discussed early on in these papers. But for the actual phenomenology, one had to wait a little bit longer. Let me first turn to the question of explaining just or reviewing very briefly the TeV scale gravity scenarios and how you get the Planck scale down to a TeV. And that's something that a number of you are no doubt familiar with, but let me just very briefly remind you and get things set up. So the two possible kinds of TeV scale gravity scenarios that we envision are either those based on large extra dimensions or those based on large warping. So let's start out with the general Poincaré invariant metric with some number of compact dimensions, which we'll label by coordinates y, and an internal metric here. And then we can also, without violating four-dimensional Poincaré invariance, include a scalar function here of the compact coordinates, which is known as the warp factor. And in order to understand how you get the Planck scale down to the TeV scale, let's just think about briefly the case where we have, say, large extra dimensions. And so here is a rough picture of the field lines in a compactification of one extra dimension. And basically, the field lines are fanning out in, say, a, well, maybe a five-dimensional fashion near a point mass source. But ultimately, they get constricted by the fact that you have this finite-size extra dimension, and they fan out in then ultimately it scales long as compared to the radius of this extra dimension, they fan out in, say, a four-dimensional fashion. And so that is the origin of the statement that the relationship between the Planck scales is given by a formula like this. For the moment, let's ignore the warp factor. And the basic intuition is that the larger you make the volume of the extra dimensions, the more diffuse the field lines are. And so that has the effect of lowering the strength of gravity or raising the size of the four-dimensional Planck mass. Okay, so that's the basic formula for large extra dimensions without the e to the 2a there. And then you just follow through the analogous algebra, basically, including that factor to get the e to the 2a dependence. So you reduce the Einstein-Hilbert action in higher dimensions down to the four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action. And so you see that this is actually the general formula where you have this factor which would be the volume if there were no warping. And in cases where there is warping, we call this the warped volume. And so from that, we learn that either by taking just the volume to be large and ignoring the warp factor, or by taking the warp factor to be large, and say the volume could be order one in Planck units, either of those two scenarios allow us a large discrepancy between the fundamental Planck mass, which could be, say, a TeV, and the four-dimensional observed Planck mass, which we know is about 10 to the 19 GeV. So that's the basic idea in a nutshell about how TeV scale gravity would work. Now, of course, this can't be the picture of how the other forces in nature work, because the typical radii one finds here are maybe down to something like a Fermi. But of course, we have observed gauge forces to behave in a four-dimensional fashion all the way down to, well, basically, the weak scale, so nearly a TeV or a tenth of a TeV. And so the gauge forces can't have this higher dimensional structure until shorter distance scales than that. And so really you have to augment this kind of picture by some kind of brain world scenario that there's, say, a brain extended along the non-compact dimensions but localized in the extra dimensions, and that the gauge forces are restricted to act within that brain. And so that's got to be a necessary part of the picture. But nonetheless, despite this apparent complication, this kind of thing naturally comes out of string theory scenarios. And a number of sort of more detailed realizations of this picture are currently being investigated in the context of string theory. One can also imagine this type of scenario, I think, in some sense independent of string theory, that you could have some kind of topological defect that's behaving like a D-brain. Okay, so that's the basic, yes.
If you don't have a compact bulk dimension, then what do you do with these arguments? I mean, suppose you have, the Randall-Sundrum type 1.
Randall-Sundrum type 1 is, that's actually the situation where you have two brains, so that actually is compact.
But if it is too far away from you, the other brain, I mean, wouldn't we get this very small M4 in that case? Well, I guess you would rule it out. You would rule out this model.
A small M4 because of... Well,
it depends on the A.
Yeah, you could... Well, so if you're speaking about the non-compact case, you may have in mind Randall-Sundrum type 2. It's actually, even though that sort of looks non-compact, that's exactly what you get when you take a compact space and you put a three brain on it. And so, whether it really is non-compact, it's sort of got this infinite dimension going down to the three brain, but the volume's getting very small there. And in fact, you do get a finite warp volume. So
Now, of course, there are other scenarios which I'm not supposed to talk about, which involve literally, DGT scenarios. And so, literally, a large extra dimension will live on a brain in gravitational terms in both cases. Let me just, I'll leave those for other people. Okay, so, but this is the basic picture, and this is what leads to the very interesting possibilities of TeV scale gravity. Now, for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to focus on, as we said, black hole production, and I'll be interested in what I call the model-independent features of black hole production. And in particular, I'll be interested in features that are visible to leading order in an expansion in the Planck mass over the energy. And so the detailed structure of the brain realization of the standard model and also detailed aspects of quantum gravity enter at subleading powers in this expansion. But those are things that are hard, and so I'm only going to focus on the, so to speak, easy things. And so that will be the basic philosophy of the talk. And in particular, I'm just going to take the point of view that anything happens when, say, the black hole reaches the Planck scale and is not, such an expansion is not justified, I'm not going to put any credence in it. Various people have speculated about things that can happen at these kinds of scales, but it, from my point of view, it's very hard to make reliable statements there. So we'll just focus on these effects that are visible to leading order in this expansion, and then we'll have to talk about how good that expansion actually is and come up with some criteria for when we can really trust this. Okay. So let's go on to the basic scenario. And so the basic picture is that we have these, move this out of the way, thanks. Okay, so the basic picture is that we can have a collision of two, say, standard model particles, partons, for example, within a proton, living on a brain. And if that collision happens at a high enough energy and a small enough impact parameter, then we can form a trapped surface. And all of this is taking place in this higher dimensional bulk. And so we've got to discuss this formation process in some more detail. And then once the black hole forms, it's going to decay. And there are actually four stages of decay, known as, balding, where the black hole loses its hair, so to speak. And then spin down, where it loses its spin. Then there's a Schwarzschild phase, and finally a Planck phase. So it's important to understand each of these phases in describing the possible signatures for black hole production and decay. So I'll summarize those. And what I'll do is, of course, go back to some of these original results, the first papers to really discuss the phenomenology of black hole production in TeV scale gravity were these two papers. And they outlined a lot of the basic facts, but there have been a lot of developments since those papers. And so I'll summarize some of those new developments. And it is very much an area where there are still developments taking place, and we don't yet have everything we need, for example, as I will say, to give full sort of very quantitative signatures for what you would see at the LHC. We're getting closer, so I'll summarize some of the, basically needs for what kinds of things we still need to calculate to actually be able to fully describe the phenomenology. Okay, so let's first turn to this formation stage, and the formation stage, we'll describe by working in this 1 over E expansion, or M Planck over E expansion, and it's in that expansion basically a classical process to leading order in 1 over E. It is just the classical
process. And so we describe that as the collision of two, well, very high energy particles with their gravitational waves, or sorry, gravitational fields. And those gravitational fields are essentially the Eichelberg-Sechsel kind of metric. The gravitational field lines sort of pancake up in the transverse direction. And so the metric actually for an Eichelberg-Sechsel shock is flat on both sides of this shock wave, and all of the non-trivial gravitational field is just contained in the matching conditions across that shock. And so we collide two of those, and the basic picture is that when you do so, you can demonstrate that a trapped surface, otherwise known as essentially a black hole, actually forms. And in fact, that forms once these two particles get close enough together and even before they actually collide. And so basically, they just have to get within one another's Schwarzschild radius, as one would intuitively expect. And so that was originally shown, or at least the existence of a trapped surface, in the zero impact parameter case by Penrose. And then Erdley and I showed it for non-zero impact parameter and gave a construction relevant not only for four dimensions but higher dimensions. And then the final work to actually find the sort of shape of the trapped surface in higher dimensions involves some numerics done by Yoshino and Nambu. So that's the basic picture and how we demonstrate that a black hole forms. Yes?
Question.
Okay,
if
sure.
We're in the regime of point-like particles, but energy is much larger than the Planck energy, shouldn't we be dominated by quantum gravity effects?
Not necessarily. And actually, I will talk more about what goes on in those circumstances in my next talk tomorrow, where I will sort of talk about how you organize the loop expansion. But it's still very classical. Basically, in this regime for, say, moderate impact parameters, but within, say, the Schwarzschild radius. Well, down to the Schwarzschild radius. At the Schwarzschild radius, you do ultimately have to deal with quantum effects, and the loop expansion.
Let me maybe ask it differently. Are you in a regime far from impact parameter forces?
Yes. Yeah, because the Schwarzschild, in this completing order in this 1 over E expansion, if E is big, we're colliding just within the Schwarzschild radius. And the short story is is there a short story? Ultimately we do have to confront quantum gravity, but I don't think we have to confront it to know whether or not a black hole forms. And I'll say more about that whole story tomorrow. Okay, so,
if you think about it perturbatively, about flat space, formation of a black hole is a breakdown of perturbation theory. But nonetheless, I think we can understand that one forms, and then what happens next is a non-perturbative question. Okay.
Thinking of these shocks as basically shocks in an effectively flat 10-dimensional space? Or
yes. Or however many.
Approximately.
Yeah. And one of the things I'm neglecting in drawing this picture is the gravitational field of the brain on which the standard model fields are located. Mm-hmm. And the reason that should make sense is, again, we're working in this large E expansion, and that's a subdominant effect. That's one of the kinds of effects we're going to have.
Are the black holes that are forming timescale black holes?
I'm interested in energies that are large as compared to the Planck scale. And so really, they're supposed to be big as compared to the Planck mass, basically. In order to be able to trust anything, they've got to be big compared to the Planck mass.
But this is an energy where you can't trust energy. Otherwise, there are small black holes near the Planck scale. Then
I don't know what a black hole is
near the Planck
scale. With mass and Planck. I don't think it's a...
It may not be meaningful, actually.
Yeah, well, we really have to understand quantum gravity, I think, there to understand those. And so what I have in mind is that, when just a little more background, this also addresses Lee's question. At least for the ones with a large energy or large mass, then we should be able to trust a semi-classical description for at least, you know, some of their gross features, although perhaps not for the detailed quantum amplitudes. And so the reason for that, of course, being that the curvature at the horizon, for example, is small. And so geometry seems to have some meaning there still, but for a Planck-sized black hole, that would just not be true. Okay, so that's the
semi-classical or classical picture. In the space-time sense, what we have going on here is this collision of these two Eichelberg Sexel shocks. And again, it's flat space everywhere except on the shocks, at least before the collision. And the picture is that you form a trapped surface that looks something like this in this initial regime. And one of the nice things is that, as I mentioned, the trapped surface actually forms before the two particles collide. And that means that we can actually find the trapped surface explicitly in this Eichelberg-Sexel geometry. We don't have to know what's going on in this region up here in this upper quadrant, where actually we do lose control of, well, or at least we don't understand even the classical description of what's going on up here. It's complicated. But the trapped surface forms down here, so we can actually find it and compute its size. And that, for example, tells you what kind of impact parameter you need in order to form a trapped surface. And also, by the area theorem, gives you a lower bound on the mass of the resulting black hole. And so that's one place where there have been actually some recent improvements. Let me just mention briefly there. So we are after an estimate of the rate of producing black holes at LHC. So we need to know the cross-section. And the cross-section is something like the Schwarzschild radius squared, as one would expect. For impact parameters below the Schwarzschild radius, you form a black hole. And just to remind you, since we are working in higher dimensions, the Schwarzschild radius parametrically depends on the mass or the energy by this power 1 over d minus 3, which is 1 in 4 dimensions. And so one would like to know more specifically what the cross-section is. And as I mentioned, that has to do with the size of the trapped surface. And there have been some improvements in the past couple of years. Well, Yoshino and Richkoff were responsible for those. And basically, actually, I'm jumping ahead. Basically, those improvements came about because they were able to find the trapped surface sort of later in the evolution up near, actually, let me go back. Okay. They were able to find a trapped surface up in this region. They kind of pushed the construction of it all the way up to the sort of last time at which you understand the classical geometry. And that led to slightly better estimates of the size of the resulting black hole, for example, whereas we had originally, Erdley and I had found the trapped surface back in this region just as it first formed, roughly speaking. Okay, so that has been one recent improvement. Let me just mention that there are some other caveats in trying to estimate the cross-section. And for example, I don't see Rob around. And Yoshino have argued that charge effects, the fact that we're colliding charged partons, can actually reduce the cross-section. So that's one effect we should think about. They did consider, however, higher dimensional gauge fields, and we need these gauge fields restricted to a brain. So some improvement is needed to really make definitive statements about what is going on there. But that's one of the caveats that we should bear in mind.
Okay. Now, from this basic cross-section for the production of black holes in the collision of two partons, what we need to do is fold in the parton distribution functions in order to actually get a rate at LHC, and I'll come back to that. The reason I'm going to postpone that is because actually getting the rate depends on some other aspects of the decay, as we'll see. And in particular, the size of the trapped surface that you form has implications for the mass of the resulting black hole. And one of the things we've got to take into account is that only if we have a large enough mass, which we'll come back to the correct values, only if you have a large enough mass do you actually have something you're going to call a black hole. And so we've got to think a little bit harder about when we have a reliable approximation where we form a black hole and when we don't, and take that into account when we're computing rates. Okay, so in order to do that, let's ask ourselves, well, what happens in this first stage where you collide your two partons, you form a trapped surface, so you've got your sort of incipient black hole, and it will be a very asymmetric object. It will have, you know, some complicated shape for its horizon. It'll have some spin. It'll have multipole moments for all of the various gauge fields that are present, and so on. And what's got to happen is we've got to realize the statement that a black hole has no hair. So it's got to settle down to something that doesn't have any hair. And in the process, you will lose some of the energy of the initial collision. And on the other hand, well, if you have your initial trapped surface, you know that that should not decrease in area. So you will absorb some of the energy in the fields surrounding the black hole or the trapped surface when it initially forms. And the bottom line is we need to know what is the size of the black hole once it has settled down at the end of this balding stage. Okay, so this is just, well, summarizing what I just said. The first thing that happens in its decay is it sheds these multipole moments. And also at the same time, it turns out it sheds its charge or color through basically the Schwinger process, an analog of the Schwinger process. And all of this takes place on a time scale which is of order the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole, because it is basically a classical process, this balding process. And so in this process, we emit some gravitational and electromagnetic and other gauge radiation. And the result is a stationary black hole. In other words, it'll be a spinning black hole, so Kerr solution. And we can certainly find this lower bound on its size from the area of the initial trapped surface. What we'd like to do is ultimately know not just the lower bound, but the actual size of the black hole. And again, we'll come back to that in estimating the rates for black hole production. And this is one of the places where we would really like to have some more work done in order to make more precise predictions, is in actually, well, improving on this lower bound and finding the actual, the zeroth order question is size of the black hole that is produced once it settles down in this classical formation process. And so this is something that I think should be amenable to numerical study, generalizing some of the things that are done in numerical relativity. And since I gather that numerical relativists, some of them are looking around for new problems, this is one to suggest. It's basically a classical problem, and we would like to not only understand what the size of the final black hole is, but we'd just like to understand better the formation process and the geometry of the black hole and its horizon as it's forming. Okay, so that's the first phase of decay. The second phase is spin down. And what happens is the black hole, once it is sort of settled down to be a Kerr black hole. So it's spinning, and it will tend to start to Hawking radiate. And the first thing it will do is preferentially radiate Hawking particles that carry away its angular momentum. So that's why we call this phase spin down, because it's, well, preferentially shedding its angular momentum. One can estimate the time scales in terms of the energy, and that's a rough estimate of the time scales. In order to actually see the structure of the Hawking radiation coming out, we need to calculate the higher dimensional Hawking emission rates for spinning black holes and various kinds of particles, spinners, scalars, vectors, and so on. And that's actually a rather hard problem. We do have something that's close to a thermal spectrum, but of course there are gray body factors from the potential surrounding the black hole, and those can have important effects. And this is something we didn't have any control over in this initial paper that we wrote, and there's been a lot of development over the intervening years in that direction, but still the problem of figuring out the gray body factors and the, say, emission rates for, well, not only scalars, spinners, and vectors, but also for gravitons, that problem has not completely been solved. So we made some initial estimates based on extrapolation from four dimensions in this paper. There have been some improvements on that, but roughly speaking, the right story came out of those rough estimates. And so here are some of the people who have been involved in subsequent work in trying to get these gray body factors nailed down and actually, you know, more quantitatively study the evolution of the black hole as it is Hawking emitting through this spin down phase. And let me just mention a couple of things that have come out of this study. One is a claim recently on the part of this group, Ida, Oda, and Park, that once they have, you know, figured out the relevant gray body factors and resulting emission rates and numerically evolved the black hole through the spin down phase, they have argued that they see that over 50% of the mass lost from the black hole actually occurs during this phase as it's spinning down. And so that's something that is not that surprising, but it's something that bears emphasizing. One should bear in mind at the same time, though, that the actual definition of, well, the end of the spin down phase is a little bit arbitrary. The black hole is losing both mass and angular momentum, and the question of, well, when is the angular momentum small enough that you call it the end of the spin down phase and the beginning of the Schwarzschild phase, there's a little bit of an arbitrary dividing line that you have to draw there. But nonetheless, they argue that you should draw the dividing line such that more than 50% of the mass loss is in this spin down phase. That's important for understanding possible experimental signatures, as I'll come back to. But one other thing I want to emphasize at the same time is that there are still some uncertainties over bulk emission during the spin down phase, and in particular emission of gravitons into the bulk region, in other words, not along the brain, which the black hole is sort of attached to. Okay, so those are a couple of things to keep in mind. So why do we care about spin down? Well, one reason is that certainly if a lot of radiation is emitted during this phase, and if it's radiation that's got to be emitted such as to carry away the angular momentum of the black hole, you will get characteristic radiation patterns. For example, if you're emitting scalars, you expect them to be primarily emitted in the equatorial plane of the black hole, so that they carry away maximum angular momentum. And so this is a possible signature to look for when you start producing black holes, is the characteristic radiation patterns. And another thing that was found in really studying these gray body factors is that you get some modification of the naive estimates based on just thermal factors for the relative production rates for, say, vectors, spinners, scalars, and so on. And in particular, vectors and spinners dominate in this phase, it turns out. And so again, they'd have a characteristic radiation pattern. It wouldn't be the same structure, but you prefer to basically emit things with spin, which in some sense makes sense that if the black hole is trying to shed its angular momentum, that's the most efficient way it can do it. But what we need in order to make full quantitative predictions is to carefully bring this whole story of computing the gray body factors and integrating the evolution over this phase where it's emitting in these various modes. We've got to bring that story to a conclusion and really understand how much energy is actually emitted in this phase, and more specifically understand what the precise spectra are, what the characteristic energies are of the emitted particles and so on. And so that's something that has not yet been completely done, unfortunately. Okay, once the black hole has emitted all of its angular momentum in the spin down phase, or a large part of it, we enter a phase where it's essentially a Schwarzschild black hole without any spin. And so that also is an important phase of the evolution of the black hole. There we go. Although at this point we should stress that that phase is quite possibly, in light of the preceding comments, a subdominant part of the decay of the black hole. Less than 50% perhaps of the mass is actually emitted in this phase. And of course this phase on the positive side is the one that we really understand the best. It is just straightforward Hawking radiation from a non-spinning black hole. We do have to think about the gray body factors and how they modify the thermal spectrum, but that's a much easier problem for a non-spinning black hole, and so we can really get some information about the power spectrum and the relative emission rates of the different kinds of particles and so on, and there's just a lot more control and a lot less work involved. And so from this phase you get a spectrum that is basically what you expect. It is essentially a thermal spectrum at the Hawking temperature, but again with these gray body modifications thrown in. And for example, you can see as signatures of this black hole formation, well, evaporation in this phase, the relative multiplicities of the particles that are coming out in the Hawking radiation, which are, of course, as mentioned, just governed by the fact that it's a thermal system. Although because of the gray body factors, there can be some minor modifications of that. For example, suppression of low energy gauge bosons is one feature that comes from the gray body factors. And there are some other sort of modifications to the purely thermal spectrum, but it is largely a thermal spectrum, as expected. Okay, so what is needed for the future? Well, we would like to have a full study of evolution through this spin down and Schwarzschild phases. This is ultimately the goal, properly incorporating these gray body factors and really just integrating step by step over the evolution, taking into account the emission rates, to really determine quantitatively the energy spectrum, relative multiplicities of, say, jets versus leptons and other things, and to really find these event shapes and actually carefully establish what kinds of angular distributions we should be looking for and so on. So that's the goal, and we are not yet quite there. Let me mention there's this fourth phase, the Planck phase, where the black hole is Hawking evaporated down to the Planck scale, and that, as mentioned, is the stage that we don't really understand once it reaches that size. Known physics breaks down. So this is the most interesting stage of black hole decay, and also just the case where we don't know what exactly to expect. We might expect, say, a few particles coming out with typical energies of order of the Planck scale, or maybe a string, if we're talking about string theory. But again, this is the most interesting phase because it is the phase that might tell us something about the fundamental dynamics of quantum gravity. So we can't make predictions, but we can hope for some hints from this phase. Okay, in terms of detailed experimental expectations, let's come back to this question of when do we actually produce a black hole that we can reliably call a black hole. So, as mentioned, the bounds on the Planck scale are around a TeV. That's the lower bound. For example, reporting from the SUSY 2007 conference, a talk there. And now I've switched over to using a precise set of conventions where the Planck mass is called MD. These are now the conventions of the particle data book. And so if the Planck mass is, say, at about a TeV, you can ask, well, at what point do you have something you can reliably call a black hole? And the answer to that, or at least a proposed answer to that, is if you have something that is up around, say, at least 5 TeV, then you have a Bekenstein-Hawking entropy that's 24, and at least that's starting to look like it could be thermal. So you'd better be at least up to some scale like that. Ideally, you'd like to be up to a higher energy before you would really call it a black hole. But you would hope that the basic considerations of black hole physics would have some relevance in this regime. So we'll...
The Bekenstein-Hawking is valid to 5. I mean, how can you calculate it? It's the area.
Well,
isn't that a bit... You put in a little, I mean, why 5 and not 10 TV? I would expect an order of magnitude of this higher. Okay.
It's a question of, this is a consistency check on whether it's classical or not, or thermal or not. And, it's a little borderline, but certainly the borderline is not lower. Let's put it this way. And ideally, it's higher than that. But, this 24, you can get something that's approximately thermal, I think, with 24 degrees of freedom. It's again, quantum effects are also will be important at some level too. So, anyway, that's
what we argue is a plausible place to sort of put the boundary somewhere around there, and one could also think about 10 TeV as well. And for such black holes, the event rates were originally estimated to approach 1 per second. But actually, it turns out that we have learned some things over the intervening years that lower those rates slightly, somewhat, I shouldn't say slightly. In particular, the amount of energy in a collision that actually goes into a black hole appears to be smaller in higher dimensions than in 4 dimensions. So when we first made the 1 hertz estimates, we only knew about the 4 dimensional answer, and the best we could do is extrapolate from that. But the result of the intervening years of figuring out the structure of the trapped surface and so on, and culminating in this final estimate of Yoshino and Richkoff, demonstrates that even at zero impact parameter, the trapped surface corresponds to a mass that is only 60% of the mass of the incoming partons. Of course, that's a lower bound on the amount of energy that goes into the black hole. And, in 4 dimensions by comparison, a lower bound is 70%. So that 10% sounds like a fairly, it's actually more than 10%. It's 10% of the whole. That sounds like a relatively small difference, but because of the way the parton distribution functions are falling off, that's actually an important difference. And actually, that leads to us stressing something else. Since this is a lower bound, we would like a more realistic estimate of how much of the energy actually goes into the black hole. And in 4 dimensions, the lower bound is 0.71, but you can estimate in the balding phase how much of the resulting energy ends up falling into the black hole as opposed to being radiated off to infinity. And those were estimates done by Diath and Payne some time ago in 4 dimensions. And they found that once you take that into account, the actual mass of the black hole in 4 dimensions would be more like 0.84 times the collision energy. And so a rough estimate for the higher dimensional situation, where we don't yet have an analog of these calculations, I'll actually give two estimates. One is a curve that just looks like that. That's the most conservative estimate, and I've just drawn it to be square because it's easier to fold in with the parton distribution functions if you draw a curve that looks like that, but that's not too, I think, unrealistic. If you take into account that really some of the radiation in analogy with Diaz and Payne's calculations actually should fall into the black hole and boost its mass up by some amount, you might try a curve like that for your rough estimate of the efficiency in producing a black hole of a given mass. And so that's this second curve. So those are just two very rough parameterizations of the mass of the formed black hole as a function of energy and impact parameter. And when you take those and fold those into the parton distribution functions, or actually more precisely when you ask Tom Rizzo to fold them into the parton distribution functions for you, you find cross sections of those sizes which correspond to, well, in the slightly less conservative case, one black hole per minute instead of per second, so the rate's down somewhat, but still quite respectable. In the more conservative case, one black hole per 10 minutes. That's at the nominal LHC luminosity. So that's still a very respectable rate, although not quite as spectacular as the one per second. What about explicit signatures? How quantitative can we be? And of course, you've heard about some of the event generators that have been used to try to simulate black hole evaporation. And one of the things I want to emphasize is that, unfortunately, so far, due to the complexities, these event generators just summarize the evolution through the Schwarzschild phase and not the spin-down phase, which we've argued is, at the very least, an important part of the decay of the black hole. And so one cannot necessarily make hard statements about what you expect to see, really fully quantitative statements. We really need to do some more detailed work. And so for that reason, I'm not going to end my discussion with some quantitative predictions, but I will just summarize some of the striking qualitative signatures that we expect to see. And so I'll emphasize there's this very large cross-section, or relatively large on the scale of things that you might expect to see at the LHC, leading to rates, which aren't quite a hertz, but maybe 0.02 hertz. There's also another effect, which is a little harder to directly see at a machine like LHC, but is ultimately an important effect characteristic of black hole formation. That is, this cross-section increases with energy because the Schwarzschild radius increases like a power of the energy. Other phenomenological consequences of black hole formation, or signatures of it, a relatively high sphericity. When the black hole evaporates, it sends stuff off in all different directions. That's unlike, for example, production of SUSY partners or various other things you might expect to see at LHC. High multiplicity of primary particles, because you have this thermal system with a large number of effective degrees of freedom, and the Hawking radiation will carry away basically the energy of the black hole in this large number of outgoing Hawking particles. In particular, those will include both leptons and gluons and quarks that produce jets going off in all different directions, and in particular transversely, and those are easier to see, in particular the hard transverse leptons. There should be, again, a significant number of these, in the, particularly in the higher end of the black hole range. And as stated, approximately thermally determined ratios of the various kinds of things you produce. You also would expect to see these angular distributions characterizing spin down. How actually visible they are in the final analysis depends on, again, better understanding these gray body factors in the full evolution. And finally, jet suppression, and I won't give too much more explanation of that. Sabina is one person who has worked on that. And that, well, basically arises from the fact that your horizon is cutting off, well, is preventing you from getting harder and harder collisions, is one way of saying it. So those are some of the basic signatures we expect. And of course, there's this question of, well, what about looking for things in cosmic rays? And that has a long history. Here are some of the people who have worked on that. In particular, if you have neutrino cosmic rays hitting nucleons in our upper atmosphere, then you could form black holes if this kind of scenario is correct. There you have center of mass energies up to around 100 TeV. And so you might ask if you could see these events and see TeV scale gravity, or possibly rule it out at Auger, which is in operation now, or IceCube, or other future detectors. In particular, third year Auger data is now out and being examined. I haven't seen any statement about that data yet in this context, so, but that's an interesting question. In particular, Anker, Doki, Feng, Goldberg, and Shapir stated that you could rule out the possibility of producing black holes at LHC with 5 years of non-observation at Auger, that could push you up to a Planck mass around 2 TeV. There are some uncertainties with this. I won't go too much into the details, but in particular, there are uncertainties about the initial neutrino flux that lead to uncertainties about actually concluding that there are bounds on TeV scale gravity. One involves suppression of the neutrino flux due to well, actually, this, let me go to the one I'm describing first. Due to a dilution of the neutrino flux in through processes where you annihilate with antineutrinos, but also there are arguments that in connection with the physics that is responsible for baryon number preservation, you can have some suppression of black hole production in these kinds of events. So. Bottom line is, if we're very lucky, we might see some hints in Auger data, but I don't think we can come up with hard bounds, and so otherwise we'll just have to wait and see what the LHC brings, and we don't have too long to wait, after all. On the theoretical side, of course, there's been a lot of work in building detailed TeV scale gravity models, which has been challenging, but in particular with these warped and flux compactifications and brain world constructions in string theory, which have been very active endeavors, we have, well, various kinds of models that people have, or realizations, I should say, of TeV scale gravity that people have put together. Okay, so that's the basic summary of sort of TeV scale gravity, but in the closing few minutes, I would like to touch on some profound theoretical issues that black hole production brings up. And so let me remind you that at whatever scale it occurs, maybe 10 to the 19 GeV after all, black hole production really does force us to confront some profound theoretical issues, and in particular, the black hole information paradox. The basic statement of that paradox is that apparently, when we think about what happens to information falling into a black hole, we need to abandon some cherished principle of physics. And the possibilities are unitarity and energy conservation, corresponding to a violation of quantum mechanics as originally proposed by Hawking. Another possibility is that we end up abandoning stability. That seems to be a consequence of a remnant scenario. And finally, a third consequence is that we need to abandon locality on scales of the black hole, so therefore macroscopic, and that appears to be necessary if information is actually going to escape. So each of these looks objectionable, and in the end, many of us now, I think, believe that the answer is that information escapes, evolution is unitary. That seems to be a widespread belief. But we really ought to understand that. So if non-locality is the answer, some form of macroscopic non-locality, we should ask ourselves, what is the mechanism for that? And in particular, how is Hawking's argument for information, well, that information doesn't get out, how is that evaded? And finally, in connection with both of these questions, we'd like to know where specifically general relativity plus local quantum field theory actually breaks down. Another way of stating this last question is to ask ourselves, well, what is the correspondence limit, so to speak, for a new physics that is not local quantum field theory plus general relativity? So I'll discuss these questions further in the next workshop, so tomorrow, but let me give a brief taste for some of that discussion. In particular, in asking what is the mechanism, if you study strings, you might first guess that the mechanism is that strings are not local, they're extended objects. And so one can, in particular, investigate the possibility that that plays a role in non-locality responsible for resolving the information paradox. You can investigate that through high-energy string scattering, which we've done. And just to make a long story short, since I have very little time, we've given recent arguments that actually there is no evidence for a role of string extendedness in the black hole story, at least in particular in giving the kind of non-locality that you would need to, well, basically to resolve the information paradox. And so that appears to be out, that first sort of naive guess that it has something to do with extension of the string, and suggests an alternative, which is, in fact, that you have an effect that is intrinsically a gravitational effect, not something to do with the stringiness, but it turns out, and well, when you look more at the details of the description of high-energy scattering, that basically in the black hole regime, ultimately, you do expect to have a breakdown of perturbation theory, and so you suspect that really whatever is giving you the correct non-perturbative physics has got to be part of the story of what is responsible for the possible violations of locality. And moreover, this suggests the, well, at least one part of the correspondence boundary where you might expect to see sort of local physics match onto some more fundamental physics that doesn't have basic locality. Let me just briefly indicate what the suggestion is. So first of all, if you're thinking about local quantum field theory states or field theory states in a background, let's consider a typical such state, which might be a state in the two-particle Fock space. And let's think about a state that we form from actually two minimum uncertainty wave packets. And so we could ask, when is quantum field theory, well, this kind of description via quantum field theory, a good description of such a two-particle state, and when isn't it? And the basic picture is that this Fock space kind of description should be good as long as the separation between the two particles is large as compared to the appropriate power of their center of mass energy with a proportionality constant, which is essentially Newton's constant. So that's the regime where field theory should be good, and we should have a, well, a good description via basically semi-classical gravity plus field theory, I should say. But once one gets to separations less than the appropriate power of the energy, we don't expect the sort of classical description of the gravitational back reaction, for example, to be completely reliable. And in fact, it seems to me that we should expect in that regime that that really a local quantum field theory plus sort of semi-classical gravity description really should break down in a fundamental way. And so this sort of bound has been called the locality bound, and it's plausible, although we phrase this in a very on-shell fashion, that this extends off-shell as well, and that could be part of the story where the of answering the question where the correspondence boundary lies. Now, this kind of suggestion that locality actually breaks down in some fundamental way, whether parameterized by that particular parameterization or by some other, seems a little, from some points of view, radical. And in particular, locality is certainly a cornerstone of quantum field theory, so you might ask whether we can really sort of believe this kind of story. Actually, I just have a few more minutes, and I'll be finished. So let me just touch on that briefly and start by asking, well, okay, if you want to say locality breaks down, first of all, let's ask the question, how do we actually characterize locality in the context of physics? And there are really two ways of studying locality. One is through the behavior of high energy scattering, if you go back to, for example, considerations of S-matrix theory and so on, where locality is encoded in various bounds on amplitudes or S-matrix elements. And in particular, in local quantum field theory, you predict a bound on the total cross-section in scattering, which is the Froissart bound, and also a bound on, say, exclusive amplitudes, which is basically the statement of polynomial boundedness. And you can ask, well, do we really expect gravity to have these kinds of behaviors? So what happens in a strong gravitational regime? And in particular, we've argued that you have cross-sections that grow like a power of the energy, not a power of the log of the energy. So it looks like gravity violates the Froissart bound. And more to the point, we think, is if you investigate what the exclusive amplitudes that fixed momentum transfer look like, it looks like they, and I'll say a little bit more about this in the next talk, they seem to violate, they seem to violate polynomial boundedness. Okay, and so as I say, I'll talk more about that in the next talk, but here we have an exponential growth in the energy. Okay, another way, just briefly, that we can characterize locality is through commutativity of local observables. That's how really it's phrased fundamentally in field theory. But let me just remind you that in gravity, we have no gauge invariant local observables because of diffeomorphism invariance. And so one has to ask how you even set up the question. And I believe the answer to that is that there are approximately local observables that can be constructed that are gauge invariant, what we call proto-local observables. And that's discussed some in these papers, including the one with Meroff and Hartle. But to make a long story short, you don't always get back in some approximation local observables from these proto-local observables. And in particular, you find limitations on recovery of local observables from strong gravitational effects, like parameterized by the locality bound. Of course, there are other reasons to suspect some kind of non-locality in gravity. One is the ideas of holography, although we haven't sharply, for example, through a holographic picture, resolved the information paradox. Also, there are a lot of conundrums these days in cosmology associated with the landscape, the Boltzmann brain problem, and so on. And so there are suggestions that these are hinting at a possible breakdown of local quantum field theory, and here are some of the references where this kind of thing has been discussed. So we still have the question of how exactly Hawking's argument for information loss actually fails. And just to make another long story short, there are indications that the calculation of of the density matrix, say, that Hawking performs, actually, if you try to set it up, that you find a breakdown of perturbation theory at an intermediate stage in the calculation. And so that would suggest a role for non-perturbative gravity, which, as we've said, could well be fundamentally non-local. So I'm obviously jumping over some things, but just to basically close that part of the story. The proposal is that information escapes from a black hole through such non-locality of fundamentally non-perturbative gravity, and that this can become important on the appropriate timescale. It needs to become important on the lifetime of the black hole through an argument from Page. Okay, so just to close, if TV scale gravity is correct, black hole production could be a spectacular effect. And we really need some more work to understand the detailed signatures. And of course, the parts that we do know and from these semi-quantitative arguments indicate that the signatures, for example, at LHC would be very prominent. They would really stand out from other physics. And then finally, as I've indicated, whether or not black hole production is actually accessible at the LHC, just thinking about it raises profound theoretical issues that I think will be helpful in guiding the next revolution in really understanding quantum gravity. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Yes.
Singularity inside your black holes, because you may have simply that you form an apparent horizon in a strong gravity region and then it evaporates. And if there is never a singularity inside, because somehow it violates the condition for ferrosterity, you may have simply that the evaporation happens with the state with a correlated. You just have to recover the correlations at that point. You are not losing information.
Well, okay, so let me just briefly say, so a more full discussion of the information paradox would be needed, but I don't think the formation of a singularity is critical. The question is whether or not the information comes out early in the Hawking radiation, namely before the black hole reaches, say, half its size, whether it starts coming out or not. The problem is if it comes out much later, it has to come out very slowly, and you end up with a remnant scenario, basically. And we could go through the details of that, but that's the issue.
Yeah, I disagree.
Well, I disagree with that.
It's not a problem of time. It's a problem of the structure. When you form the information paradox is related, if you like, at a very well-defined picture of black hole evaporation, where you have the black hole diagram for the collapse, and then you attach this Minkowski wedge. Basically, it's related to the fact that you have an event horizon at the end of the day, which is related to the fact that you have the singularity inside.
Yeah, the real question is when the information comes out. And if you argue that it doesn't come out at the Hawking evaporation for whatever, basically by locality, okay, then it has to come out at the end. And if it comes out at the end, there are very basic constraints on energy and information that imply that it will have to come out extremely slowly. That's the basic statement, and I could explain more of the details, but it would take a little more time.
Yeah, so let me suggest some good topic for discussion in the next workshop. So Michele Arzano has a very interesting paper in which he shows that violations of locality to commutators in quantum field theory imply deformations of the asymptotic symmetry, the asymptotic Poincaré algebra. So it seems to me if you want to argue for violations of locality coming from a quantum gravity theory, they would be reflected in effective field theory in non-zero commutators of space-like separated objects, but presumably vanishing with some length scale. And that, by Michele's argument, implies a deformation of the asymptotic Poincaré invariance, and that leads to potentially other observable consequences.
Okay, I'm not familiar with this work. Is this within field theory, or is this in the context of gravity?
Within field theory.
Okay,
let me suggest, since Michele isn't here, maybe it's something maybe we can discuss later.
Yeah, in particular, if it's just field theory, then part of the, in some sense, at least from one viewpoint, the basic postulates of field theory include vanishing of the commutators outside of the space-like separation. So I'm not quite sure what's going on.
Right. So the issue is, if you want to see quantum field theory as an effective description of an underlying quantum gravity theory, do you, in a gentle way, violate the postulate of locality that is commutated of space-like separated observables? And it postulates that you do. And then extract from that, you then have to modify the usual construction of the asymptotic charges, and it turns out that the consequence is exactly a modification of the asymptotic Poincaré symmetry.
Well, okay, yeah, that would be interesting to see. So it sounds like it's not really field theory, and that one is postulating some fundamental violation of the commutator. So that's some modification of field theory and then trying to find the consequences. So, yeah.
Last question.
Yes, Steve. Going back to some hormone game, just making the black hole and seeing what comes out.
Yes.
From the brain point of view, from being on the brain, I should be able to write some effective field theory operator that tells me two incoming stuff, two outgoing, you know, and whatever's measured. And I guess I'm wondering what scale would you put on the bottom for those operators, or if you can do that.
It's a pretty complicated operator. It's not sort of writing it as an operator is probably not the best way to think about it. Basically.
So okay. So is this somehow it break that up the effective field theory viewpoint from the brain perspective, or?
Is it somehow a
breakdown of effective field theory behavior, or?
Well, you know, roughly speaking, there are a lot of states. Once you cross the Planck mass, right, you've got a lot of new states, in a sense, that are relevant. And you could try to sort of summarize those in an effective field theory fashion, but, you know, really, you ought to think more directly, I think, about the black hole description.
Okay, so Steve, there'll be any follow-up questions?